Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dodson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on State Representative House Laker's bill to fully fund all K-12 public school students for the 2020-2021 school year. Samantha Horton reports some Indiana businesses and institutions are one step closer to being protected from COVID-19 lawsuits. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Safe Coalition for Human Rights Foundation founder and president, Dr. Kehlani Gopal. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. The Tri-Creek School Corp Board has granted its superintendent, Rod Garden, a request for administrative leave and is expected to name an interim replacement following allegations of grooming behavior levied against the school leader this month. The Times reports an internal investigation conducted last week found no evidence of sexual misconduct. The probe followed an anonymous letter that drew attention to observed interactions between the superintendent and its students in his district. The school district's attorney and a regional teachers union representative both confirmed the lengthy letter was emailed January 14th to school administration, members of the Tri-Creek School Corp Board, and the Indiana State Police, expressing concern about relationships developed by the Lowell District's superintendent. Barbara Deardorff, Regional UNISERV Director with the Indiana State Teachers Association, said the anonymous letter, titled Compilation of Witnessed Grooming Behaviors of Tri-Creek Superintendent Rod Garden, was a collection of multiple teachers' observances over time. A copy of the letter, obtained by the Times last week, alleges the superintendent paid special attention to middle school and high school age boys, trading texts with students, offering rides in his personal vehicle, and giving the boys, quote, longer than comfortable back and shoulder rubs. According to the school district attorney, a Title IX investigation was opened the morning after receiving the letter. In accordance with the Title IX policy, Garden was asked to work from home and not to contact students, staff, parents, or community members pending the results of the investigation. The Tri-Creek School Board meets in executive session on Saturday at 1 p.m. and will have its next public meeting at 7 p.m. on February 11th. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson. At the State House, the Indiana House voted 93-2 Tuesday in support of Schererville State Representative House Laker's bill to fully fund all K-12 public school students for the 2020-2021 school year, regardless of whether students attended classes in person or virtually due to COVID-19. The measure now heads on to the Indiana Senate for consideration. Slager said the pandemic caused many traditional public schools to shift from in-person classes to remote learning. Under current law, schools receive 85% of tuition support per virtual student, which is defined as a child learning 50% or more of their instruction online. This means many schools would qualify for the lower funding amount because of moving classes online. Slager's bill would bring funding to 100%.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
Indiana businesses and institutions are one step closer to being protected from COVID-19 lawsuits. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, a House committee passed the bill, but some still worry the protections go too far.
Members of the House Judiciary Committee amended the bill to try to limit protections to actions taken in response to the pandemic. However, Ashley Hadler with the Indiana Trial Lawyers Association says the amended bill is still too broad. She wants language that only protects and gives immunity to claims related to exposure or injury due to COVID-19.
This bill appears to be a solution in search of a problem. We have all of the mechanisms required under Indiana law to evaluate these claims currently. What we need in this bill is a tie to COVID-19. We do not have that here.
Hadler says the updated bill also goes too far in preventing claims against long-term care facilities on issues like staffing shortages. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
After setting more than a dozen COVID-19 records between October and December, Indiana has started the new year significantly lower than those record-setting months. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lauren Chapman reports there are a number of factors that could contribute to that decrease.
In November and December, the state averaged about 5,500 cases per day. But in January so far, it has averaged about 4,000. Sean Granis, Regan Streiff Institute Vice President of Data and Analytics, says that could be for a few reasons, including Hoosiers avoiding testing and the vaccine rollout.
Positivity rate, while it's been up and down, it's been up and down within a band, which suggests to me we probably are seeing fewer cases right now, at least in part because of the lower testing.
Granis also says as time goes by, we'll not only have more data, but hopefully a better understanding of what has contributed to this decrease. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lauren Chapman.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana's unemployment rate fell to 4.3% in December, dropping almost a full percentage point from the month before. That's according to numbers released by the Bureau of Labor Statistics Tuesday morning. The data shows a surge in the number of Hoosiers who were working or actively looking for work last month. That largely drove the drop in unemployment. There were significant increases in people working in trade, transportation, and utility sectors, while leisure and hospitality jobs saw losses as COVID-19 infection rates grew. The new unemployment rate places Indiana as the best in the Midwest for December and remains much lower than the national rate of 6.7%.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Republicans in a House committee Monday voted to make it harder for Libertarian Party candidates for Indiana governor and U.S. Senator to get on the ballot. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on legislation that would impose signature requirements on Libertarians that major party candidates must already meet.
Democrats and Republicans who want to run for U.S. Senate or governor must collect 4,500 signatures of registered voters, 500 from each congressional district, in order to get on the primary ballot. Doing so isn't easy. It requires time and, importantly, resources. Libertarians don't have primaries in Indiana. Instead, their candidates for those offices are chosen at their state party convention. Republican Representative Ethan Manning says Libertarian candidates should also meet the signature requirement.
Really just wanted to more closely align those party candidates for those statewide offices.
Democratic Representative Matt Pierce questions why.
A cynical person might think that this bill arrived because the Libertarians did extraordinarily well for what we might call a third party.
The 2020 Libertarian candidate for governor got more votes than any other such candidate in state history. The bill now heads to the full House. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Indiana Black Legislative Caucus says it's pleased with progress so far this session on its justice reform agenda. The major police reform bill of 2021 is well on its way. Supported by law enforcement, public defenders, and key organizations in Black communities, the measure requires de-escalation training for all police officers. It treats chokeholds as deadly force, and it allows the state training board to decertify officers who commit misconduct. other parts of the Black Caucus's agenda gaining traction, a bill to create a law enforcement misconduct database and an extension of the state's current traffic amnesty program, allowing drivers to more easily get their licenses back. Black Caucus Chair Robin Shackerford says conversations with Republican leaders have been productive, and she's pleased to see Governor Eric Holcomb's administration working behind the scenes on the issue, though she wishes he were more out front, too.
To help put a face on the issue and let people know that the leader of the state is behind most of this agenda and willing to help out, I think that would greatly help.
Shackelford says she hopes the major police reform bill remains unchanged as it moves through the legislature.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The daughter of a former Indiana Republican governor wants to become the state Democratic Party's next leader. Trish Whitcomb announced Wednesday her bid to replace state Democratic Chairman John Zodi, who announced in November he would not seek re-election to the position. Whitcomb's political work includes being manager of Democrat Glenna Ritt's successful 2012 campaign for state schools superintendent. She is a daughter of Ed Whitcomb, who was governor in 1969 through 1973. Another possible candidate is Mike Schmuel, who was campaign manager for former South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg's 2020 presidential campaign. The state Democratic Central Committee is scheduled to pick a new leader in March.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Safe Coalition for Human Rights founder Dr. Kalani Gopal.
The month of January is National Slavery and Human Trafficking Prevention Month, and it's a problem that is not only here in Northwest Indiana, but all across the country. Dr. Kalyani Gopal is the founder and president of the nonprofit Safe Coalition for Human Rights, and she is with us to talk about this very important topic. And thank you for being with us on Regionally Speaking today.
Absolutely. My pleasure, and thank you for having me.
Well, will you please explain to us what human trafficking is and what types of human trafficking could be found here in Northwest Indiana?
Sure, I'd be glad to. So human trafficking is a recruitment of individuals for the purpose of exploitation. So they use force, they use manipulation, and they use deceit. And it's called the actions, morals, and plan model that they use, where individuals are conned, to use very simple language here, into being trafficked. And trafficking itself is when, for example, a mother might take her child and allow her child to be sexually used by another person in exchange for financial support. So especially if you look at COVID and the situation we're going through right now, mm-hmm. lots of families are at very, very high risk of losing housing. And so in exchange for turning a blind eye and not seeing what's happening, the family can get financial support. And we call that sextortion. So it's happening, for example, where someone would pay the mother for the diapers, for the childcare, for rent money. In exchange, they exploit the child for sexual purposes. That is human trafficking. That's mm-hmm. a classic example of human trafficking that's happening right now. Most people think of human trafficking as kidnapping or some child being brought from a foreign country and being sold here, or it happens in other countries. Not in my backyard, right? It happens everywhere else. It's not happening in my own backyard. It could literally be happening right now at a nearby neighbor's house, and we wouldn't even know.
Does human trafficking only happen, say, in illegal underground opportunities? We think about these with criminal gangs and the like here. It's more beyond that, isn't it?
It's far beyond that. This is happening with regular families. It's happening in schools. For example, in Northwest Indiana, we have the highest rate of sexual abuse, for example, in the state of Indiana, correct? So they are the highest rate. And so what's happening with our kids in school is that they're on TikTok, they're on a whole bunch of apps. there's about 45 apps that people have identified, at least if not more, that these young people are on. And parents are not allowed to go on those apps. So they have secret passwords, they have secret chat rooms. And in all the process, what happens is that they... But what happens is that these young people then are going on these apps. And they're on these apps, they're actually communicating with complete strangers. So you can have someone who's like 14 years old on one of these apps because they're bored, they're home, and actually they have greater access to the internet now than they ever have because they're on it all the time at school. So this is causing a huge problem. And so when they go on these apps, they're then talking to complete strangers who could be actually 45 and 50 years old, but they're telling them they're 16 and 15. And they're very understanding and very kind.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned things like within human trafficking that might be involved with kidnapping and things like that. Does physical violence have to be involved in human trafficking?
Not at all. A lot of it is just kindness and friendship. I know it sounds really strange, but if someone is paying attention to you, you're lonely, you're bored, you don't have much to do at home, or you're being abused at home, that could also be happening. And then this other person on the other side of your internet or your phone or wherever you're speaking to them is able to just listen to you, and they take a year sometimes to groom. So the whole process is called grooming. There's no violence involved. It's a lot of grooming. And what they do is they gradually entice this person into trusting them. Once you develop a child's trust, you then have them. That child, the value of that single child is anywhere from $5,000 to $10,000, depending on how many times you can sell them and how you can sell them. One picture of the child that's uploaded on the internet, you can have 5,000 to 10,000 to 50,000 downloads and make money from that.
Mm-hmm. Do victims of human trafficking self-identify themselves as being a victim of a crime and ask for help immediately? Or is it a situation where you have to almost coerce people to tell the truth and tell about their problems?
You know, I'm so glad you asked that question. It's such an important question, and nobody ever asked that question. But they never self-identify. Rarely, if ever, will they tell you they're a victim of human trafficking. And that's the biggest problem we have, because if you don't know that there's a crime being conducted against you, why would you report it? And why would you tell anyone? So what they see themselves as able-bodied, willing participants in the crime that's happened against them. It's almost like the Stockholm Syndrome, right? They think that person is kind to them, they're nice to them, and they feel horrible about turning them in, and they also see themselves as willing participants. So the informed consent for 10 and 12 year olds doesn't really exist because they don't understand the whole concept of informed consent.
Now you mentioned,
and they don't self-identify.
Now you mentioned about the fact that it's difficult to find if they won't tell you how they feel, if they won't admit to being in that situation. How can one spot the signs of human trafficking?
So there's three critical signs that I look for. One of them is a huge level of secrecy. So for parents, for example, they can look for sudden change in friendship, attitude changes, irritability. They're up at night. These kids are anyway up at night watching videos and TikTok and all these other, YouTube. Mm-hmm. But they're up at night on their phone texting constantly. Making appointments, disappearing from home for half an hour, 45 minutes. Going and coming back, changing their clothes. They have one set of clothes, another set is in their backpack. Coming in and out of cars. So we had one family where, the trafficker was actually sending the customers to the house. And they were going in and out of the cars at the end of the street or right in front of the house sometimes. So these are changes, sudden changes in behavior, a lot of secrecy, two phones. Sometimes they're always having this particular phone always has to be on them because they get into trouble with the trafficker. Initially, there is no physical punishment for the victim. But as time passes, the physical abuse and emotional abuse occurs. So that it's so addictive that they live for that one moment when the trafficker is going to be nice to them.
Probably talking too, as you mentioned, even though there may not be any physical violence necessarily, there will certainly be consequences.
Absolutely.
Because you've got very serious sexually transmitted diseases that will come
about. Absolutely. So then, you know, and then these children will not talk about it. And what happens is they get more severely ill, and that's when they find out. That's when parents find out.
What organizations is the Safe Coalition for Human Rights working with here in Northwest Indiana to help in the fight against human trafficking?
Well, we've been very, very fortunate. Northwest Indiana is very aware. You know, I am very proud of being a resident here. We are working with St. Catherine's Hospital. We have a memorandum of agreement and understanding with them. They're working with our survivors of human trafficking. We have a house that the Poor Handmaids of Jesus Christ has literally given us to work on. And we have four residents that are going to be living in the house between 4 to 6. Right now we have 3 and 2 babies. So we have victims of human trafficking staying there. Right now we're the only house that's housing survivors of human trafficking in Northwest Indiana. And we have that organized, so we have St. Catherine's, we have Methodist Hospital helping us out, and we have the Continuum of Care, which oversees 30 organizations in Northwest Indiana. So Dr. Sharon Liggins, who's also a board member, is part of that. We have incredible amount of support. I just got off the call with Sojourner's Truth, and they have we are working with them because they're helping their residents with vouchers and so forth. So it's a very close-knit, a wonderful, wonderful community. We are very, very fortunate here.
You mentioned these safe houses, which is one of the major goals that the coalition is working on, and they're right. Just starting out. There aren't nearly as many as there should be. But what kind of efforts, you mentioned some of the organizations that are assisting the coalition here. What can an average person do, for that matter, if they feel they can, to help work towards establishing more safe houses so that victims of human trafficking have someplace literally safe to be?
Well, if they have a house that's available, what an average person can do, for example, if they have a home or they have another home that they're not using and they want to donate it to Safe Coalition, we can transform that home into a housing unit for our victims of trafficking. Victims of trafficking don't look like bad ladies and people out on the streets, and they're not dirty and filthy or anything else. They're actually very lovely young people. They look exactly like us. They don't look any different. And so what they really need is a safe place that they can grow, they can finish their education, they can go to college or learn a trade. You know, many of them are into cosmetology, and one of them actually who's working with us is trying to finish her GED, and she's going to school and she's studying, but she's got learning disabilities, so she needs help with that. So the kind of work that we can they can support us is tutoring. We always need tutors. We need tutors, we need teachers, we need people who can teach life skills. And if they have actual property, that would be helpful, but they don't have to. You know, someone who wants to volunteer and help, they can call. There's so many areas they can help us with. If they have a marketing background, they can help talk to organizations about supporting these women. You know, we have one person who just donated little care packages. And that was lovely because that's what they need. You know, it seems like shampoo, soap, nothing major.
Are there organizations that are existing right now here in Northwest Indiana? In particular, I'm thinking of the St. Jude House, which is in
Absolutely.
Crown Point. They look particularly to help not only family members who have suffered abuse at the hands of a spouse or other means of abuse, but they have family members who they're very concerned about, and it's a safe place for them to stay, too. Are these groups like
Absolutely.
This a big help, too?
Absolutely. St. Jude is lovely. I've worked with them for the past 20, 25 years. I know them extremely well. The beauty about St. Jude is they're also affiliated with St. Anthony's, so they have their residents go there. They have group homes. They have the group, not group homes, but they have the group support. They are shelter, and they only have so many people that they can take in. But the good thing about St. Jude is anyone can walk in there and get help if they're a victim of domestic violence or sexual assault. So, yes, absolutely. They're a great group to work with.
Now, Dr. Kapal, is there any number or a web address that people can go to if they would like to find out more about the Safe Coalition for Human Rights or offer some information or offer their help in volunteering?
Absolutely. If they can go to SAFE, that's Safe Chair, C-H-R, SAFE, like being feeling safe, so safe, safechr.org. They can also call us. We're always accessible. They can call us at 219-513-8508. That's 219-513-8508. They can even email us or stop by our office on Calumet Avenue. Mm-hmm. We are in Munster. It's 9335 Calumet Avenue, Suite D. They're welcome to stop by. We absolutely need volunteers. I myself a volunteer for the organization. None of us get paid. We actually look for individual donations. We look for grants, any kind of support. We've had a lot of support from the Lake Area United Way. They've given us grants. Legacy Foundation has given us grants. And we're also working now with Pinnacle Hospital, which is a private hospital of doctors, but they're also willing to help us and work with us.
Well, it's great to hear
that. So we do need donations. We are very lucky, very fortunate.
It's nice to hear so many people are volunteering and offering what services they feel they can do to help fight the issue of human trafficking. And we thank you for being with us, Dr. Gopal, and talk about this today.
Thank you so much for your time, and thank you to all your listeners as well.
Dr. Kalani Gopal is the founder and president of the nonprofit Safe Coalition for Human Rights.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.